Hello and welcome to AcePod 2.1, brought to you by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. Gonna hit a few different areas in the hoops world today, starting off with a look at the Big Ten, since we didn't do that on the MGO podcast this week. Instead, we were dancing on Mark D'Antonio's grave, and we have no regrets. But yeah, I'll fill you in on that. I'm going to do a segment on the women's basketball team because we also have not touched on them, and they are coming off a great week and now moving up in the NCAA tournament projections. Also be answering plenty of mailbag questions on the men's team. So let's dive right into it. No about mailbag questions for this first segment. I am just going to freewheel on the Big Ten for a little bit because it's been a pretty interesting week, including I feel good for the Athletic's Eamon Brennan, who puts together their Bubble Watch post, which is a must-read if you have a subscription to the Athletic. That is a post I have followed since it was on ESPN for forever, and it's really useful come tournament time. And until now, the Big Ten had 12 teams that Eamon needed to write up for the Bubble Watch post because nobody had quite inched ahead to the point where you could call them a lock. But after Maryland beat Illinois in an extremely well-played game that I watched start to finish and also included it a very interesting touch from Maryland, I know we tend to not rate Mark Turgeon's in-game coaching particularly high. And there are some good reasons for that, given his history, at Maryland. But in this game, he got the better of Brad Underwood in part by, throwing out a, zone defense look that, and Maryland has been almost strictly man to man, under Turgeon, and that, caught Illinois a little bit off guard and proved quite successful, helped them pull out a 75-66 win in Illinois. They shut down Georgi Bishanisvili and Kofi Coburn. Those guys combined for just 12 points and went 1-for-8 inside the arc. Anthony Cowan was absolutely phenomenal. 20 points, 7 assists, only 2 turnovers. He has been really excellent. They managed to actually get by with a something of an off game from Jalen Smith, who was 4-for-7 inside the arc and had 11 rebounds, but only 1-for-5 from beyond the arc, only 1 block, not quite as impactful as he normally is in 36 minutes. But Maryland gets a good shooting game and just and shuts down Illinois inside the arc. Illinois goes only 14-for-39 on twos. Just a really impressive performance from them on the road. One of the I'd say more impressive victories in the Big Ten this year, and that has moved Maryland into lock status for the NCAA tournament. They now have a 1-game lead in the Big Ten. They're 9-3, 19-4 overall. It would be very unlikely for them to lose out at this point, but they could practically do that and still have a pretty good tournament resume. So congratulations to Maryland. And you might be surprised to see that the next team after them in the Big Ten standings right now, tied with Illinois at 8-4, is Penn State, a team you don't normally associate with basketball success. But when you look at Bartorvik allows you to customize his tempo free stats, and if you look at national rankings over the last month, Penn State, this covers 8 games, is the number 6 team in the country with the number 32 offense and the number 3 defense. Maryland is not far behind at 11th. Purdue, which I'll get to in a moment, is actually 3rd in this, even though they're 5-3. They are a very weird team. But Penn State has now won 6 games in a row. That includes their 75-70 road win at Michigan State that had started to put the Spartans in a bit of a tailspin before they lost to Michigan. That includes the road win at Michigan, unfortunately, and the road win at Nebraska, which does not really count as much, but also home wins against Ohio State, Indiana, and Minnesota. They had a three-game skid before that, but prior to that, they had a home win over Iowa. They have an impressive resume in the Big Ten. They've also beaten Maryland. Lamar Stevens has become kind of a mid-range killer, and with Mike Watkins playing well, Isaiah Brockington stepping up, Miles Dredd finally starting to get going a little bit. This is a dangerous team, and we'll see if they can hold on. A lot of the improvements feel like they could kind of vanish at any moment, but for the moment, Penn State is one of the better teams in the country, which is wild to say. Meanwhile, Michigan State is going in kind of the opposite direction. If you look at those same rankings over the last month of play, Michigan State is 3-5 and 31st in Torvik's rankings nationally, and their offense is all the way down at 91st. They just have not really been able to shoot the ball from the outside enough to make up for the fact that they're shooting under 47% from two-point range in that span. It's been just kind of an ugly stretch for Michigan State writ large, now on a three-game losing streak, Wisconsin, Penn State, and Michigan. But in particular for Xavier Tillman, who has struggled to finish in that span, and Michigan's game plan largely revolved around daring him to shoot while blitzing Cassius Winston and rendering him the least effective we've seen him against Michigan in a couple of years. So Michigan State, it doesn't get a whole lot easier for them this week either. By the time you listen to this, they will have played at Illinois. So that may change the tenor of this conversation a little bit if they manage to pull that out. But if they don't, it certainly doesn't get a whole lot easier either on Saturday when they host Maryland. So they had an easy Big Ten schedule to open things up. They sort of eased their way in. They got their Northwestern experience, both ends of it, out of the way early. And now, other than a road game to Nebraska, every game they play from here on out is tough. Because after Nebraska, which is the game following Maryland, they host Iowa and then go to Maryland, go to Penn State, and then finish out the Big Ten schedule hosting Ohio State. So they're only currently projected to go 12-8 in the conference. That would not win it. That would tie them for third in KenPom's projections, along with Illinois, finishing behind Penn State in second, and Maryland in first. Maryland's projected to go 14-6. Michigan State has to figure things out pretty quickly because there's not a lot of let up in their schedule. And they've been moving in the wrong direction. Teams seem to be figuring out how to play Cassius Winston. Indiana had success with a similar defensive strategy to Michigan's in terms of blitzing that pick and roll, forcing the ball out of Winston's hands. And State's had a tough time figuring out how to counter that and also who to play alongside Tillman. And they really don't have much of an answer for what to do if Tillman isn't playing well. And that's been the case the last few games, and they've lost the last few games. The last thing I really want, you know, the middle of the conference is still so muddled. Michigan does have a chance, certainly to move up some spots, because you have pretty much the entire conference sitting between 5-8 wins. Might be tough to catch Penn State and Illinois, who are at 8-4, while Michigan's at 5-7, but. Rutgers could potentially be in play at 8-5, especially since Michigan gets to go to the rack if they can steal a game on the road there. That could help them move towards it. And better bets to catch are Michigan's already tied, obviously, with Ohio State and Indiana as of Tuesday and Tuesday afternoon, I should say, since there are some games tonight, although not involving those teams. And then Purdue and Wisconsin are both teams in front at 7-6, and Minnesota at 6-7. That could potentially backslide. Although, as I mentioned, Purdue over the last month rated by in by Torvix metrics as the number three team in the country, even though they have three losses over that span. A lot of this is the fact that they just caught absolute fire from three last Wednesday against Iowa and beat them 104-68, which usually you don't get single games skewing metrics too much, but between that and them holding Michigan State to 42 points at home while putting up 71, you have these major blowout wins that kind of that warp these efficiency metrics a little bit. So, and then you also throw in there that they lost at home 79-62 to Illinois. They lost by 7 at Rutgers. They had to eke past Northwestern on the road and only won that game by 3. And the game right before, they bombed Iowa out of the building. So it's really tough to tell. Purdue has massive splits home and away. They are way, 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 way better at Mackey. That was a tidbit from Dylan Burghardt of UM Hoops, his most recent newsletter, which you should sign up for. It's free. I think it's dylanburghardt.substack.com. I should pronounce his name right. That would help you find it. dylanburghardt.substack.com. B-U-R-K-H-A-R-D-T. It's called Dylan's Hoops Dispatch. And Purdue, he points out Purdue has a 53.8 effective field goal percentage at home and makes 42.3% of its threes. These are in conference games. In conference road games, they have a 41.9% effective field goal percentage, and they're shooting just 27.3% from beyond the arc. So it's a wild shot chart to look at. Purdue, I don't know how well they're going to be able to bring it come Big Ten tournament and NCAA tournament time, but they are looking great in the advanced metrics right now because they have managed to just stomp some teams at home. But I don't know. They're just a really difficult team to figure out. I still am very skeptical of them because they can only play one of their two best players on the court at the same time, between Travion Williams and Matt Harms. So that seems like it puts a pretty hard cap on them, unless they are absolutely shooting the lights out from beyond the arc. Finally, before wrapping up on the Big Ten entirely, I think we should point and laugh at Northwestern a little bit. They were on the verge of doing Michigan and the rest of the conference a pretty massive favor. They were up by as many as 18 points at Rutgers on Sunday and just watched that lead slowly trickle away in the second half. The win probability chart looks a whole lot like the slow climb up before a very fast descent on a roller coaster. This game ends up going into overtime. Rutgers wins 73-77 in when KenPom, he splits the games up into quarters. Northwestern won the first quarter 21-9, first 10 minutes. Rutgers won the fourth quarter 23-9, and then won overtime 11-7. It was just absolutely brutal. You could see it coming from a mile away. Rutgers is a pretty good team. They got Geo Baker back in his on-fire mode in this game. You catch that every once in a while. He dropped inefficient 25 points and had some really clutch shots in the fourth quarter in overtime. And Northwestern just couldn't get the shots when it needed. But they were honestly lucky to be in this game in the first place. They go 11 for 23 from three. They're only 17 for 43, which is under 40% inside the arc. So it was a little bit unsustainable. You could see the fall off coming, but man, was it brutal when it hit. But couldn't happen to a better guy in Chris Collins. So despite that not being the best thing for Michigan, didn't really hate to see it. And with that, that should about cover what we would have covered in the Big Ten segment on Sunday. I won't dive into too much more detail because there are games tonight. I'm sure we'll do a little bit more catch-up on the next MGO podcast, or if I have to do another podcast next week. I will do it. Stick around, and in the next segment, we'll dive into some women's basketball updates and compare their tourney chances with the men's.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at BlankenshipLawyer.com.
Of course, NAS are the letters that spell. Not like life or death. I'm a rapper. My poetry's deep, I never felt. Not like half man, half amazing. No doubt. Not like life or death. I'm a rapper. My poetry's deep, I never felt. Not like half man, half amazing. No doubt. Not like
earth, wind, and fire, rims and tires, bulletproof glass inside is the realest driver. Planets in orbit, line them up with the stars. Tarot cards, you can see the Pharaoh Nas. Iron Mike, Messiah type, before the Christ, after the death, the last one left. Let my cash invest in stock, came a long way from blasting. Techs on blocks, went from Seiko to Rolex, owning acres from the projects with no chips to large cake.
I know Nas Hillman's nickname is Nasilla, which is fantastic, by the way. But it's very hard for me not to call her Nasty Nas, given Nasir Jones and that song. And the way she plays. Speaking of which, the women's team is now 16-7, 7-5 in the Big Ten. They are riding a 3-game winning streak. Now that the television networks aren't scheduling them at the same time as the men's games, I've actually been able to tune in recently. So I watched both the home win over Purdue last Thursday, which was a hard-fought 66-63 victory, where Michigan jumps out to an early lead, but Purdue just hangs around and hangs around and hangs around and almost climbs back into it. But Naz Hillman ends up putting Michigan up by 3 with a late bucket, and Purdue is not able to really do much of anything with their final possession. Hillman led Michigan in a pretty spectacular effort with 19 points, 12 rebounds, 6 of them on the offensive end of the floor. Also had a Kenray Johnson with 17 points and 10 rebounds in that game, 5 of them on the offensive end. And Haley Brown with 16-5 herself, while Amy Dilk dished out 8 assists. This was also, I believe, Maddie Nolan's debut in the starting lineup. Michigan has been dealing with some injury problems ever since Kayla Robbins went down with an ACL injury, and then Danielle Rausch also got injured. So Maddie Nolan has stepped into the starting lineup the last couple games and has been doing a lot of the little things pretty well. Still looking for a shot a little bit, but she has definitely been scrapping out there. She pulled down 6 rebounds in this game and headed 4 blocks. And she is by far not the tallest person out there. So that was a great effort on her part in a game where Michigan only rolls with a 7-person rotation. Kim Barnes-Rico a little tied by with these injuries. So that was the first game of this past week, and after that, Naz Hillman was rewarded with both the ESPNW National Player of the Week and Big Ten Player of the Week. And then last night, Monday night, since this is probably coming out Wednesday morning, Michigan just absolutely blew the doors off a pretty good Minnesota team. Both Purdue and Minnesota are teams hanging around the bubble. Michigan entered this week projected as a 10 seed on ESPN's Bracketology, but they come away with a 77-52 blowout win on the road. They shoot well from downtown, 6-14, but mostly this was about just pounding the ball into the paint. Michigan ends up with 44 points in the paint compared to just 18 for Minnesota. Their efficiency is really high up there as well, while Minnesota cannot get easy looks at the basket and cannot get many to go down. This was a really great game for Amy Dilk. She did a great job of kind of running the offense and also finding openings for her jumper, both from beyond the arc where she goes for 2-for-4, and kind of finding spots around the free throw line or working through the post players on give and goes to get little short jumpers. She finishes with 22 points on 9-of-15 shooting, adds 8 assists, only two turnovers, also pulls down 4 rebounds. That's an important contribution from her with Robbins out. Robbins was a pretty good secondary rebounder for this team, so they need the help they can get. Hillman, who was by far the focus of Minnesota's game plan, the broadcast mentioned throughout that Minnesota coach Lindsey Whalen had basically told her team anybody but Hillman, and she was getting double and even triple teamed at times, but still manages to drop 21 points on 9-of-14 shooting, pulls down 3 offensive rebounds among her 8 total, also takes advantage of these doubles with some great kickouts and post-to-post feeds. She finishes with 5 assists against only 1 turnover herself. Kenrae Johnson with another solid game, 12 points, 5 boards, 3 assists, and just a really impressive all-around team effort, particularly on defense. Minnesota shoots just 35% for the game. They actually shoot better, slightly better from beyond the arc than inside of it. So Michigan now, after these two games, has moved up to an 8 seed on ESPN's Bracketology, and that's a great spot for them to be in, considering they were, I believe, on the outside looking in on this field only a few weeks ago. They are one of the 8 Big Ten teams in the field, and they currently have a better standing than the last two teams they played. Minnesota is now one of the first 4 out. Rutgers is down at a 10 seed right now. So you've got Purdue's also at a 10 seed, Ohio State's at a 10 seed. So in terms of how things are shaking out in the Big Ten, Michigan actually appears to be in great shape to make the tournament now after their 2 straight wins, and also with the way that the schedule finishes out. They have a tough game on Thursday at home against Northwestern, who is probably the second best team in the conference right now. And then they travel to Rutgers on Sunday before getting a little relief next Wednesday with a bottom feeder program in the Big Ten in Illinois at home. So things are setting up nicely there. We do have mailbag questions for this segment, so I'm going to start with one from Ben via email. Really appreciate your updates on the women's basketball team. To be honest, I've never really gotten into it before, and you've inspired me to tune in. That makes me happy. But I'm still pretty ignorant about how to watch it intelligently. I'm a big men's Big Ten basketball fan, and I don't even really know the recent history of women's college basketball other than who the few top-tier programs are. One thing I'm curious about is how the Big Ten compares to other conferences, and broadly speaking, what's something you like about watching women's college basketball that you don't really get from the men's game? Also, is there a particular long-form piece or maybe a certain writer you would recommend so I can start to educate myself on the history? All right, there's a lot to dig into here. I'm going to start with, I'm still informing myself about the game myself. I'm still kind of looking for resources. I do know the Big Ten, not historically a power conference, has yet to produce a national champion. Has produced one national champion, which was Purdue in 1999. You can also shoehorn Maryland in there if you want to get a second one, but they won that title in 2006, which is well into the ACC days. Big Ten rarely even gets a team into the title game. Rutgers, again, before they joined the conference, made it in 2007. Michigan State was the last true Big Ten team to make the national title game in 2005. Purdue made it in 2001 in addition to their victory in 1999. And Ohio State made it in 1993. The good and bad news about women's basketball history is that in terms of the NCAA championships, you only have to go back to 1982 to inform yourself on all this stuff. So I just went to the NCAA website and started scrolling through their some of their women's basketball stuff for that. But interestingly, this year, the Big Ten is shaping up a lot like the Big Ten is shaping up in the men's side of things. The Big Ten has the most bids by conference right now in ESPN's bracketology with 18 teams in, and that's with Minnesota as the second team left out of the field. They have, but they don't really necessarily have a strong national title contender. Maryland has been mentioned as a bit of a dark horse, and they're projected for a 2 seed right now. But otherwise, this is mostly a conference that's hanging around with, I mean, Northwestern's the second best team in the conference right now, and they're projected as a 4 seed. So it's you know, both because of, and Iowa could also, is also a 4 seed. So you have kind of like what Michigan State was expected to be and what actually Maryland might be now on the men's side of things. You have one team that people are kind of looking at as one that can maybe make a run, and the conference looks strong overall, but when you're looking at who is expected to make the Final Four, who's expected to win the national championship, you have to start with South Carolina, which actually just beat UConn to kind of really nail down their status as the number one overall team in the country right now. You've also got Baylor, which has had a ton of recent success, projected as a number one seed. Oregon, which has got Sabrina Ionescu as the third number one seed. And while NC State has moved up to take the fourth one seed, you also have UConn hanging around as a 2 seed. So it's really tough to crack that upper tier in women's basketball. There's still a gap between those elite teams and still a pretty decent chunk of the top 25. But that gap has still been closing. I mean, right now UConn's projected as a 2 seed. That's kind of evidence enough, given I just named South Carolina, Baylor, and Oregon, and NC State as 1 seeds, that things have shaken up a little bit since the days when UConn and Tennessee were kind of just trading titles. And the Big Ten has a little bit of work to do to catch up in terms of the elite top programs, but they've really filled out the middle of the conference well. And as for the question about what I like about watching the women's game compared to that I don't really get from the men's game, it's certainly from watching Michigan, you get a very different style of play because they're running almost everything through the post. You don't get as much post play in the men's game as you do in the women's game. If you're somebody who isn't a big fan of how the game is kind of turned into, if you can't get a layup, you're going to work it around for a 3-pointer. It very much functions differently in the women's game. You have fewer 3-point attempts. The 3-point shot isn't as big of a threat in the women's game, and so you have a lot more focus on getting it into the post. Some very impressive, refined post play, and you also have players showing off more of a mid-range game. So you certainly see different offensive strategies. I'm curious to get into it more as sort of a wonk because for the most part, I tend to watch the women's game as kind of a break from work since I'm watching basketball so much with kind of my analytic-minded brain turned on that, or analysis-minded brain turned on, that if I can take a break from that with something that I don't have to necessarily write up, I usually take advantage of that. But I'm trying to do more content on the women's team. They deserve that focus. And I've really enjoyed kind of seeing how stylistically it is quite different from the men's game. So I might be digging into that a little bit more in a post. I do want to break down, Kim Barnes-Arico drew up a really nice play to get Oz Hillman open for the ceiling bucket against Purdue. So I think I might get a little picture pages of that going because I do want to start digging into some of the differences. As for how to educate yourself on the history, I mentioned the NCAA.com site. I haven't had a chance to, I could have done more research before starting this segment, but I kind of had to strike while the iron was hot in terms of recording this. In terms of following women's basketball coverage in general, which is kind of how I've immersed myself in it, is what is following along with the current game, and as and they start filling you in with the history kind of as you watch a little bit, especially since one thing that's really great about the way women's basketball is being presented right now is that they know there are a lot of people who are new to the game, who are still getting, who are kind of just getting into it. And so a lot of the coverage is focused on putting things in context. And for somebody who's, remembers Rebecca Lobo and Lisa Leslie, and remembers, you know, the Pat Summitt, Gina Auriemma stuff, but other than that, had not a lot of awareness of what was going on in the women's game, and very little awareness of what was going on even in Michigan with the program. It's been interesting to kind of go in from current times and then have the history kind of bleed in from the current analysis. And in terms of writers that I'd follow right now, I had a few to recommend for general women's basketball stuff. Fansided's Women's Hoops blog, High Post Hoops, covers both WNBA and college. Their main reporter is Howard Megdahl. That's Megdal. Over at ESPN, covering the women's hoops beat, there is Michelle Vopel. I hope I'm not butchering her name, but it's Michellelle. Sorry, Vopel is Voepel. Her Twitter handle is at Michelle V. And then SB Nation's Natalie Weiner covers a lot of stuff for SB Nation, but she does a lot of live tweeting of big women's games, and she's a very worthy follow in general. So would highly recommend those three. And then you've also got, if you're looking for coverage of Michigan, look no further than the Michigan Daily Women's Beat. The three that I saw on the masthead are Brendan Roos, Kent Schwartz, and Jack Kingsley. So you can follow along with those guys to get updates on the women's team. Another question from at Lord Razor. Is the men's or women's team more likely to make the NCAA tournament, or if both are on the right side of the bubble, which is more likely to win a game or two? This is interesting because I do think both teams are going to make it in. Eamon Brennan, I should have noted, has moved Michigan from the work to do category to should be in after their victory over Michigan State. So it takes something for the men's team to fall out of the field. At the same time, I just mentioned how secure the women's bid looks like right now. So I would say the women's team actually has a slightly better path, clearer path to the NCAA tournament. Also based on just how tough Michigan's schedule is, the Michigan's men's team is schedule is down the stretch. But if Michigan makes it in on the men's side as a 10 seed and on the women's side as an 8 seed, you're about the same chance there of winning that first game. And that second game becomes a big issue if you're on, especially on the women's side, on that 8-9 line, because you will be playing the one seed in their home building. Michigan has had this experience before, and right now is actually projected to have the experience again of having, if they win their first game, having to travel to Waco to play Baylor. And that tends to be a recipe for a blowout. So you definitely want to see Michigan on the women's side finish this season strong enough so they can bump up to a 7 seed, get off of that 8-9 line, and at least feel like, even though you're going to have to go to a 2 seed and play there to get your second win, there's a big enough drop off between the ones and the twos that that'd be a pretty significant move to make. So Michigan's already moved up a little bit. Hopefully they can keep that momentum going on the women's side. The men's team, we'll see how their ceiling is raised with Isaiah Livers back. But right now, I'm having a tough time seeing them win a Sweet 16 game. So we'll see. Both of them kind of have somewhat similar ceilings right now. Only one last question about the women's team from at Hoover Street, our buddies at Hoover Street Rag. Is it fair to say that the women's team has handled their injury situation slightly better than the men's side, all caveats about competition, import of missing players, etc. baked in? Unfortunately, all the caveats make it really, really tough to analyze because, I mean, we've discussed it so much on both the front page and in the podcast, the main AMCO podcast, about just how critical Isaiah Livers is to the men's team, not just in terms of what he brings to the team, but what is missing in terms of who fills in for him, who fills in for the guy that fills in for him, and how that impacts rotations and lineups. He's such a critical piece to this team. At the same time, the women's team has only dressed 9 players at Minnesota, got into some foul trouble in that game and still managed to survive it. You know, they've been throwing a freshman out there and have survived after 2 injuries, 2 pretty significant ones. So, you know, the men's team has started to level out and was actually starting to adjust on defense and do a little bit better in that regard without Isaiah Livers. But if you're looking at, like, who has fought through it and done it with the most success, I think you'd have to go with the women's team. And with that said, going to take a quick break and then come back with some more of your mailbag questions. And these are all focused on the gentleman.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com.
All right, let's ride that funk into the men's segment. First question comes from at Dan Rarig on Twitter. With Isaiah Livers' return and Brandon John's improvements, can we consider Michigan to be a good, albeit not great, defensive team again? Seems like the communication and rotations have been much better the last 2 weeks. I would agree that Michigan has been much better the last couple weeks, and that actually extends before Livers' return. They have had 5 of their last 6 games holding their opponent below 90 in adjusted defense. So this is taking into account opponent quality. But Michigan has been quite good on that end over the last 6 games. Even the lone exception was allowing an adjusted 95 points per 100 possessions to Illinois. They scored 64 points in 63 possessions in a game where Michigan lost by 2 because their offense could not shoot. So overall, the defense has been keeping them in games for the last six. It does seem like they have figured some things out. The Michigan State game was really encouraging in terms of Michigan showing that they can change their style of play and still be good defensively. And it's definitely huge to have Livers out there. It's huge to have, instead of needing Johns as a starter and then having to decide between having Franz Wagner potentially guard bigger guys who can kind of bully him around a little bit, or having to bring in more of a center type in Austin Davis, or a guy who's kind of stuck in between the two in Colin Castleton. It does seem like things have gotten a lot smoother, and that should only improve with Livers settling back in. You know, we haven't really gotten to see Michigan was a good defensive team to start this season, and three of their four worst performances this year by adjusted defensive efficiency came with Livers out. The exception to that was the home win against Iowa way back in early December, when Michigan scored 103 points and decided to let Luka Garza go off against single coverage. And also, Iowa has a pretty tremendous offense. So I think this is a pretty solid defensive team. They're still finding their footing a little bit. We do have to account for the fact that these last six games haven't really featured much in the way of an elite post scorer. Michigan did face Kofi Coburn and limited him pretty well. Caleb Wesson has not been as good of a post scorer lately as much as a stretch guy, and he hurt Michigan as a stretch guy. So there are, you know, some caveats to be sure. Michigan hasn't faced, you know, Travion Williams again. They don't have to face Luka Garza again. But they'll get Travion Williams in a couple weeks. And other than that, there isn't a kind of terrifying bully post player out there on the rest of the schedule. Because Jalen Smith is not a guy who's going to knock you over. And Michigan's last game is at Maryland. But other than that, I guess Wisconsin, you know, Nate Reivers can do some things. And Micah Potter's been a nice addition for them. But it's not the gauntlet that Michigan went through earlier this season. And also, hopefully, they've made some improvements in post play, even if we haven't really gotten a chance to see those come through against elite back-to-the-basket players yet. From at Colin TJ, what's the biggest change Juwan Howard can make right now to max out this team's potential? There are a couple things that come to mind. One is directly inspired by the Michigan State game. Is I'd like to see a little bit more of Eli Brooks being used as the primary perimeter defender as a way to save Xavier Simpson a little bit more for offense, because Brooks has been pretty much Simpson's equal on defense. In some circumstances, he's been better. He did a better job on Cassius Winston, albeit with a better game plan around him, and also Isaiah Livers on the court, which helps, on Saturday against Michigan State than Xavier Simpson did last month in the Breslin Center. And the other adjustment also kind of goes along with that, which is I would like to see more of Brandon Johns at the four, kind of eliminate Austin Davis's minutes there as much as you can, and which I think can really be entirely, because Brandon Johns is plenty big enough to guard some of the more centerish power forwards out there. He's done a good job at that, and then you get a mismatch on the other end that I like. Michigan has plenty of length on defense, and Teske down low, or Davis down low if he's substituting in for Teske, provide some bulk. And Davis is much better on offense if you have him as the five instead of the four. And then that also frees up some time where maybe I think some of Teske's problems this season have come from the burden he has on both ends of the floor, because even though he was playing around the same number of minutes last season, he was not nearly as featured as a scorer in the offense. His usage has gone up considerably. And with that added offensive workload, you know, it can be tough to keep up with the, you know, really important defensive work that he has to do, especially as the center. So if Michigan can kind of adjust a little bit, maybe steal a couple minutes back for Teske with Davis, because Davis has been a serviceable break-even backup center and is showing some nice offensive stuff without being a mess defensively. I think those adjustments could potentially maximize Michigan's best players in a way that they haven't really done so far this season. I'd also love to see, and we mentioned this on the podcast that dropped Monday, see more lineups, see more time with Brandon Johns, Isaiah Livers, and Franz Wagner all on the court at the same time. Obviously, circumstances have prevented that happening for the most part because of injury so far this season, but now would be a good time to start getting those lineups worked in if they're going to be viable come tournament time. Speaking of tournament time, a question from Dan via email. I'm thinking we might be a really dangerous team come tournament time, Big Ten and NCAA. We've shown the ability to get hot, win on neutral courts, and we open a three-point attempt gap on everybody. If our shots fall, big if, I feel like we can upset a lot of teams. Am I crazy? Not at all, Dan. That's kind of my a lot of my thinking on this is, yes, Michigan struggles a little bit on the road, but they're not a team designed to function very well on the road in the Big Ten in terms of, you know, they're not a team that's going to keep up with in terms of the free throw battle anyway. And we've talked about this. So teams can really open up a wide foul margin on Michigan at home. That goes away when you hit the neutral courts. So one of the major bugaboos for Michigan gets mitigated a little bit there. You also don't deal with teams like Purdue, who can apparently only shoot in their own building. You know, kind of negating Michigan's three-point attempt advantage. Hopefully Michigan is also able to shoot better once they fully incorporate Isaiah Livers back into the proceedings. So, yeah, I do feel like Michigan can upset teams. You know, when they were at full strength or somewhere close to it, you know, while still very much working Franz Wagner in, they beat Gonzaga on a neutral court. So and this is a team that's capable of playing with just about anybody. There isn't a truly dominant team in college basketball this year. So, I mean, I don't necessarily expect it, but if things come together right, this team absolutely could make a run. This question from at Dr. Garbs on Twitter. Where do you see Michigan landing as a seed in the Big Ten tournament, and what teams are your ideal draw? I see Michigan landing somewhere in that 6 to 9 range. Nice, I guess. Not really. It's going to be hard to move up. It's just such a cluster in the middle of the conference that it, you know, mobility is going to be tough, although I mean, things could change in a hurry. But Michigan did dig themselves a little bit of a hole. They're starting at the bottom in terms of the non-NUs. And in terms of matchups I'd want, I'd be happy to see Michigan get a team without a dominant big man. So if they caught Rutgers again, I think that'd be nice, even though Rutgers plays crazy hard. They're also not a great shooting team. Given Purdue's home splits versus anywhere else, even though Travion Williams was very good against Michigan, I still wouldn't mind that matchup. Ohio State without DJ Carton seems like a decent matchup for Michigan on a neutral floor. Indiana would be great just because I don't think they're very good. But I would like to avoid Illinois and Iowa. I'd like to avoid Michigan State. And would definitely like to avoid Maryland. They seem to be, right now, the clear-cut best team in the conference, even though Michigan State has an efficiency margin advantage ahead of them. I think a decent amount of that has to do with strength of schedule. So we'll see how that levels out. This is another one from our friends at Hoover Street Rag. KenPom has Michigan finishing 9-11 in the Big Ten, 4-4 the rest of the way, all home wins plus at Northwestern. Understanding a myriad of other issues go into this, would let's say 19-14 be enough to make the tournament? That would include a 1-1 record in the Big Ten tournament, to be clear. And right now, that's kind of exactly where Michigan is projected to land. Both KenPom and Torvik have Michigan going 9-11 in the conference and 18-13 overall heading into the Big Ten tournament. And given that Torvik has that projection and also has Michigan at over 90% to get into the NCAA field, I would say that's plenty. I think that Gonzaga win is going to go a very, very long way. Beating Michigan State is another nice feather in Michigan's cap. And if things get hairy on the bubble, I think there will be you know, some big hitting factors taken into account, and just the fact that Michigan has, you know, already six quadrant one wins currently, including two that qualify for the top half of that, the quadrant 1A wins. That's going to be tough to ignore, especially if Michigan is going against teams that just have not played the same level of schedule. I think the committee's probably going to value just what a gauntlet this team has had to go through. In a related question, from Tim Shields, who I'm told is getting married this weekend, so congratulations to Tim. What do we have to do with Livers back in the lineup to get an injury bump from the selection committee? What could that bump look like, assuming we finish strong? The injury bump isn't really, I don't think Michigan's going to get, by my understanding, a bump in terms of where they would land in the seeding. But if their resume is being compared, if they end up on the bubble and their resume is being compared to another bubble team, that's where Livers' injury would be taken into account, as if another team was, you know, played at, with fewer injury issues over the season and had a very comparable resume to Michigan's. Livers' injury could be the tiebreaker in that situation that gets Michigan into the field over that other team. I don't think it's going to move them up any seed lines, unfortunately. So I think it's just, there isn't going to be a bump. It's just going to be, hopefully this doesn't come into play, because it'd be a rather ugly finish, I think, for Michigan to end up really on the bubble. So I'm going to hope that Livers' injury really doesn't end up being taken into account by the selection committee. Next one from at Emmy Pelega 2. It's minor, but do you know why there is a discrepancy between net rankings and KenPom/Bart Torvik? The latter are close to each other and about 10 spots ahead of UM's ranking in net. This one's pretty simple. They're trying to do two different things. Net is looking at what you have done. So that is pretty much a results-based formula that goes into that one. Whereas with KenPom and Torvik, they're still using your four factors numbers regardless of your wins and losses as a way to project how good your team actually is, as opposed to how good their resume is. So they're measuring two different things. And I think that's perfectly fine. Net, I'm glad sides more towards the what have you done, because I do think it's important to actually take into account wins and losses when you're figuring out which teams deserve to make the tournament field. But if I were betting on college basketball, I would be looking at KenPom's ratings instead, or Torvik's, because those are the ones that are actually trying to project the true quality of these teams instead of just what the wins and losses tell you. Whereas net is much more about just telling you wins and losses. So that explains the 10-spot discrepancy, because Michigan has had some hard-fought games against quadrant one teams, but they're still only 1-5 on the road and only 6-8 in quadrant one games, according to the net team sheet on warrendolan.com. Competing in those games isn't helping them as much as, say, beating Gonzaga by 18 in one of them is helping Michigan in KenPom. I hope that made sense. Last question is from my former Latin teacher at ASTEM00. What's up, Andrew? I know the number of incoming commits will have a lot to do with it, but do you think Austin Davis might be trending towards staying in Ann Arbor for his final season? It has become certainly more interesting now that Davis has clearly moved past Colin Castleton and is the better option as the backup center. But I still think it's hard to see a path, in my opinion, unless Castleton decides to give up his spot by transferring out, which I don't think is something Michigan would want him to do at all. We've said many times to, you know, don't give up on a big, especially a guy like Castleton, who we knew coming in was going to be a bit of a project, needed a lot of physical development, and most of his issues on the court have had to do with needing that physical development. He gets pushed around out there. At the same time, you can very much see the potential with him. And also, you know, given where Austin Davis was at last year compared to this year, you can anticipate a decent amount of improvement outside of just strength and conditioning, I would say, in terms of just Castleton's all-around game. At the same time, Davis has made himself viable. If there's an open spot, they should absolutely give it to him. I mean, we'll see. I'm not anticipating an open spot with the way they're recruiting. And the fact that Jace Howard probably takes a scholarship spot if Michigan does not add another recruit to the 2020 class. Although there is increasing momentum in the Josh Christopher department. But that's a different podcast or a different post. But also complicating matters in terms of Austin Davis is the fact that you've got Hunter Dickinson coming in, and at over 7 feet and 260 pounds, Dickinson is going to be a day one contributor, I would assume, as a backup, so and possibly even a starter. So between Dickinson and Castleton, plus you've got some lanky guys playing at the four where you can go with some small ball lineups that are really interesting. Isaiah Todd could be an interesting option. Brandon Johns could play the five now that he's become more comfortable. We've seen a little bit of experimentation with that. I still wouldn't, if I had to bet, I still would bet that Austin Davis comes back, does not come back next year. But I think his chances have certainly improved with the way he's played over the course of the season. And even if he doesn't come back for his fifth year, that may be because he sees an opportunity elsewhere to, you know, play major minutes, maybe at a max school or something like that, and decides that's a better opportunity for him than fighting for maybe a plurality of the minutes in what would probably be a three-man rotation at Michigan unless Colin Castleton departed. So we'll see. A lot of it very much has to do with factors outside of Davis's control, I think, but he's made himself a viable option, and that speaks well to both him and the coaching staff. And with that, that'll be all from me for this week. I want to thank everybody for listening and send out a thank you to the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship for continuing to sponsor the Ace Pod. I will be back sometime within the next couple weeks, hoops schedule depending. And thanks, everybody, for listening.